Welcome, welcome one and all to the Earth to Humans podcast, the podcast where we remind you that there is a planet out there with more than just you on it.
Awesome. I like that. Is that like our official new tagline?
I don't know. Maybe it could be.
Did you just come up with that off the cuff? That's great.
I did.
I like it.
I did. I mean, it was like prompted from like lots of conversations about it, but yeah.
Yeah.
This is Earth, and that's your face. Right. I need more slap from it. That's it. That's the one. And I'm joined with the one, the only Matthew Podolsky. How you doing, Matt?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. COVID-free. That's what everybody says, even if they have COVID. But, you know, like...
Right. If you don't know you have it, then you don't have it.
Yeah. Like, especially if I don't get tested, then I don't have to think about
right.
it, you know?
Exactly.
So... Game on.
That's terrible.
It's terrible. Quarantine. Wear a mask. Be smart. Social distance. Matt, you got a special treat for us today.
I do.
We've got a little bit of the passion project that you have had for the last, what are we like, looking at like 2 years now? You've been looking at this, working on this. Listeners to this show are no strangers to Common Land. But today we're going to bring to you an episode from that series, from season one, and Matt is here to tell you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, a few months back, we've shared a few sort of episodes from Common Lands here on the Earth to Humans feed. But the one that we're sharing today, it's an episode that had a really strong impact on me because it's the first Common Land episode where I took this dive into the Native American history of this area. So our first season of Common Land was focused on this National Conservation Area in Southwest Idaho near where I live, the Morley Nelson Snake River Birds of Prey National Conservation Area, which is home to the highest nesting densities of birds of prey anywhere in North America. Super unique area. I wanted to explore some of the indigenous history of this area for the series, and I had this amazing opportunity to interview the chairman of the Shoshone and Paiute tribes of the Duck Valley Reservation, and man, I mean, he shifted my worldview with some of the things that he said, you know?
Yeah, that's badass.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you'll kind of hear some of that in the episode, right? I kind of started off by like explaining that, you know, I'm someone who has always been super fascinated by archaeology and, you know, sort of like figuring out sort of the history of like ancient peoples, like using, you know, the remains and the evidence that's left behind. Right. And like, right in the opening, I mean, when I first started this interview with the chairman of the Shoshone and Paiute tribes, and he's currently the chairman, but he also served as the cultural resources director for like several decades, right? So that's his background. And the first thing he told me when we started the interview is, don't talk to archaeologists.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, I don't trust them. You shouldn't either. The things that they're going to tell you about our people... and our culture are inaccurate.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And does that come through in this episode a little
bit? Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, right at the beginning, yeah. Like, you know, you'll hear right towards the beginning, you know, after we do our sort of like introduction and sort of title sequence for the show. I mean, it's sort of me explaining what I just said and him essentially being like, don't talk to archaeologists. Right. And I mean, like I did talk to archaeologists. Right. I mean, so
why'd you do that?
Well,
he said no.
I know, he told me not to, and it actually made me like really curious to like you know, get this perspective. I actually went out and like sought out like two sort of differing opinions like within the field of archaeology. And so the three main voices in this episode are, you know, the chairman, this guy Ted Howard, who I told you about. And then I interviewed one archaeologist who like very much sort of fits into the stereotype that you might imagine.
Old school.
Yeah,
fundamental.
Totally like old school. And like, you know, he needs like hard, concrete archaeological evidence if he's going to, you know, make any sort of claim about like what past, you know, like what the sort of ancient history of a tribe looked like. Right. And then I also interviewed this other archaeologist who had a like totally different perspective on it. And, you know, is talks a lot about like the importance of working closely with tribes and, you know, listening to like the oral history traditions of those tribes and, you know, talking about like the importance that there is really like important information and like data to be gleaned from these oral history traditions. And so these two really differing opinions. And so I wanted to kind of show like how much difference there is. And I mean, that's one of the things that Ted Howard talks about as well in the interview I did with him is like, none of these archaeologists agree with each other. And it's totally right. You know, he's totally right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The whole thing was a super fascinating like exploration for me. And I think like of all the episodes I worked on in that first season of the show, it was like the most enlightening and like the greatest sort of learning experience for me. So I am like super excited to share it with the Earth to Humans audience for that reason.
That is so cool. Let's step into the soul of Matt and walk this journey with him.
There was raptors, and so many of them in one place, hawks, eagles, whatever. They're here because the Creator, for whatever reason, this is where they congregate. This is where they've been for who knows how long. All of these lands, these canyons, especially the Snake River, is an area where resources have been for our people, always. That's why you'll find a lot of sites along the Snake River corridor. Campsites, fishing sites, there's burials. It's because this is where life is. Water is life, and that's where our people survive. In this entire area, anywhere you go, you're on the homelands of some tribe.
That was the voice of Ted Howard, chairman and former cultural resources director for the Shoshone and Paiute tribes of the Duck Valley Reservation. Although the Shoshone and Paiute people once lived throughout southwest Idaho, the Duck Valley Reservation is about 290,000 acres, a little over half the size of the Snake River Birds of Prey NCA, along the southern border of Idaho with Nevada. Up until this point in the series, the focus of our storytelling has been very one-sided. We began our story with Morley Nelson's arrival in southwest Idaho in the late 1940s, but just 100 years before Morley moved to this area, its human population looked entirely different. You're listening to Common Land, a new podcast series produced by the Wild Lens Collective and Radio Boise, with support from the Bureau of Land Management, the Birds of Prey NCA Partnership, the Archives of Falconry, and a grant from Patagonia. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Common Land tells the stories behind protected areas, and in Season 1, we are exploring the creation story of the Morley Nelson Snake River Birds of Prey National Conservation Area, an area that once served as the lifeblood for a thriving human society. Archaeology has long fascinated me, and as someone who grew up surrounded by the ideas of Western science, it's my inclination to look to this field of study when seeking information about the ancient history of the Shoshone and Paiute people who lived in and around the Snake River Canyon. But Ted Howard's words of advice to me were,
don't talk to archaeologists. Because they'll tell you all kinds of theories. They don't know none. I just laugh at them sometimes because of all of the stuff they come up with. I said, where the hell did you come up with that? You know, I think the only way to learn is to have a little bit more interaction with tribes and also to understand, try to understand what tribes are saying rather than trying to change what they heard.
Dr. Mark Plew is an archaeologist and anthropologist with Boise State University who has worked extensively in the Snake River Canyon region.
Most of the time that I've been in Idaho, there was very little communication with tribes. There was no sense on the part of archaeologists that that was something that was really necessary. And so there was no consultation whatsoever.
Anthropology's history is largely colonial. We come in and we're recording them. And this happens worldwide and often leading to the demise of individual indigenous peoples. I'm Stephen Sims. I'm a professor emeritus at Utah State University. My specialties in anthropology is the American Desert West and human evolutionary ecology. We routinely interact with tribes now. That wasn't happening when I started in the early 70s.
The lack of interest that the archaeological community had in consulting with tribes at the time when Mark Plew and Stephen Sims were beginning their careers goes a long way towards explaining Ted Howard's mistrust of archaeologists. But the lack of trust goes much deeper. One of the strongest points of contention between the archaeological community and many tribal governments and Native Americans has been the question of when humans first arrived in the Americas.
Indians do not support the migration theory. The land bridge, we do not support that stuff. But we believe in, and tribes believe that this is where the Creator put us. This is where we were created. And there's a lot of oral histories that will tell you about those things.
The land bridge theory has been around for decades. While the details have changed over time, the theory remains almost universally accepted within the scientific community, despite continued strong opposition to this idea within Native American communities. The theory goes like this. During the last ice age, lower sea levels created a land bridge connecting what is now eastern Russia with modern-day Alaska. This allowed humans and many wildlife species to move between Asia and the Americas.
We don't know much about that early colonization, but a little bit more is being found north in what is now Alaska, and that it appears that there may be some very early colonization 20,000 years ago into Alaska, and then what's called the Beringian pause. They might not have been able to get south because of ice from the height of the last ice age, but nobody's really quite sure. But then it looks like that there's a at least one, and the argument now is accommodating more than one migration south, one along the coast and one on the interior.
But the convention was that, you know, they'd come over in waves across the Bering Strait, you know, 10, 12,000 years ago and so forth. We now think that there are probably a number of different migrations, the DNA evidence relating to early Paleo-Indian populations, as we refer to them, suggests that there are probably at least two gene pools that arrive, probably at somewhat different times.
Although the details continue to change as new archaeological evidence is discovered and analyzed, there is scientific consensus that humans first arrived in the Americas via this land bridge. It is also true, however, that the land bridge theory has been misappropriated by racist ideologies and used to discredit and diminish Native Americans' rightful claims of land ownership by falsely portraying them as recent arrivals on the continent.
And so the respectful way for, I think, everybody in this to be is to avoid being too ideological, where this is my belief and you must respect it. I agree with that. But this is my belief. You have to accept it as true. I don't have to do that. Because we have our own history, often recent history. In fact, we may be living it in American politics right now, where things that are deeply held beliefs simply didn't happen that way.
The reality is that there remain many unanswered questions about how, when, and why the first people arrived in the Americas. But
it's very clear that people are in the Great Basin. Paisley Five Mile Point Cave in eastern Oregon has clearly got solid dates in the mid-14,000 years ago area.
Paisley Cave is just a few hundred miles from the Snake River Canyon, and it is the site of the oldest definitively dated evidence of a human presence in North America.
Yeah, people were here 15,000, yeah. Probably.
Right.
It's entirely possible that, you know, people could have been here and actually witnessed the Bonneville episode. You know, could have been.
The Bonneville episode referenced by Dr. Plew is an important geological marker in Idaho and the Great Basin. Around 14,500 years ago, as glaciers were receding and the ice age was nearing its end, a natural dam holding in the waters of Lake Bonneville in northern Utah was breached, sending a flood of epic proportions down the Snake River. Ty Korn, archaeologist and historian for Idaho Power, explains.
When what used to be Lake Bonneville, where, you know, basically the Great Salt Lake is now, broke, yeah, it's responsible for almost everything you see here. And in on kind of like a joke large scale, I mean, it's easy to walk next to a river and see gravel bars here and there and some riffles in the sand there. But here, it's an order of magnitude larger. I mean, landforms that look like terraces, in Boise are actually the result of a single catastrophic flood event.
It's estimated that at the peak of the flood, 33 million cubic feet per second of water was flowing through the Snake River Canyon. If you remember our discussion about water levels at Swan Falls Dam from episode 4, you'll know that currently the river is managed to maintain a flow of 3,900 CFS at Swan Falls.
A huge volume of water over a relatively short period of time, you know, flooding through this area. I don't think it went over the rim here, but it wasn't too far down from it.
And there is a good chance that the distant ancestors of the Shoshone Paiute people witnessed this event. I mention this to provide some context and to discredit the idea that Native Americans are recent migrants to this region.
In order to interact with the Native American point of view, everybody needs to respect time. And they, in a broad sense, have always been here. When you're starting at over 13,000 years ago, you're dealing with 430 human generations. Nobody has a genealogy that long. I like to think of it as the light coming on to the continent of human presence. The rub being is that we have no historical analogies of humans moving into regions that are not occupied by other humans. That only gets to happen once. Fifteen thousand years ago, the process begins sort of in stops and starts. It's widespread, though, but by Clovis, you have a continent-wide, at least for North America, a continent-wide cultural tradition that's very distinctive. And it lasts from about 13,000 years ago down to about 12,500.
The name Clovis comes from one particular archaeological site in New Mexico, but the term is used by archaeologists to reference a continent-wide cultural tradition, which is defined by a distinctive style of projectile point. These Clovis points have been found at archaeological sites across North America, but they begin to change around 12,500 years ago, when a variety of factors, including dramatic declines in large mammal populations, started to lead to local differentiations in culture and tool making.
By 4,000 to 5,000, years ago, you have a pattern emerging that's probably relatively similar to what we find in the most recent time frame prehistorically, which is common in the Birds of Prey area. Basically, by 5,000 years ago, I think we could reasonably describe most of the populations as being seasonally transhumant, meaning that they're just moving from one location to another in a series of rounds. Ethnographically, historically, as we know, something about the local populations, the Western Shoshone, Northern Paiute in this area, we know that many of them wintered in these larger canyon areas, the Owyhee, the Snake, and so forth, and then seasonally made these movements classically to, you know, Fairfield and Camas Prairie, that kind of thing, and then kind of cycled back or circled back to the major canyons in the fall and winter period. That pattern of transhumance is one that doesn't really go away even into the later period of time.
Our people did not live on reservations. We were not farmers. People moved with the resources. You know, then in the summertime when it gets warm, they go up into the higher mountains to gather resources, you know, various resources that are ready for harvest, whether that be roots, you know, choke cherries, you know, some groundhog, deer, and they go off and do that. And when the salmon are running, they come back down to the rivers. In wintertime, they go back down to lower elevations. And that's the way our people live. We live with the earth. Our people always say, take what you need, but always leave enough that it will always be there.
There are some sites that appear to be habitation sites, although they're probably short term. Keeping in mind that most of the folks, including the known historic populations of the area, they're highly mobile, fairly diffuse distributions. So they're hunters and gatherers, and foragers in particular, so they're moving about a good deal. There are some structures, prehistoric structures. These are residential structures that have been identified in the area. And there are actually a couple of them within the NCA.
While there are a few discrepancies between the descriptions that you just heard from Ted Howard and Dr. Plew of the culture and lifeways of the Shoshone and Paiute people and their ancestors in the Snake River Plains region, points of contention between tribal governments and the archaeological community remain. And you just heard one of them in Dr. Plew's reference to prehistoric structures in the NCA.
Well, prehistory is different in different places, you know.
Sure.
Prehistory here is quite a bit apart from what it is in the American Southwest or certain areas of the Eastern Woodlands, you know. So it depends entirely. It's formally a period anywhere in the world prior to written records.
These areas or sites are referred to as prehistoric. We don't have a prehistory. We have one continuous history. And these sites that they call prehistoric are contemporary sites.
Yeah, I try to use ancient history. Whether it's prehistory or pre-literate, to the expert, they can seem benign. But to other people, they invoke the Western concept of progress. So the term gets loaded. And there are fundamental anthropological differences between societies that use oral transmission of their history and written. But beyond that, it's all history. So it's more accurate to use the term for America, pre-Columbian or ancient history of a tribe, because it respects them as having real history. Oral history is powerful. It can actually have tremendous time depth, but then all of us of the Western tradition should know this because we have Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey, which weren't even told for 500 years after they supposedly happened.
This dispute over terminology exemplifies in many ways the contentious relationship between tribes and those seeking to uncover the history of those tribes from a Western science perspective.
But then you ask an archaeologist about his theory and ask another one his theory, they don't agree.
These disagreements between archaeologists that Ted Howard points out are not restricted to terminology. One of the most contentious topics in the field of American archaeology is the impact of disease on Native American populations in the first few hundred years after first contact with Europeans.
So continentally, yes, disease depopulation was significant.
But just how significant? In 1910, James Mooney, a highly respected anthropologist with the Smithsonian Institution, concluded that the population of North America before European contact was 1.15 million inhabitants, an estimate that was based on the accounts of the first white settlers to interact with Native American societies all across the continent. This estimate remained largely unquestioned until 1966, when Henry Dobbins calculated the population of North and South America to be between 90 and 112 million people before European contact. Dobbins's research revealed the impact of waves of disease that spread throughout North and South America, largely before any Europeans reached these areas. The disease spread faster than the European settlement attempts, meaning that earlier population estimates, like Mooney's claim that only 1.15 million people lived in North America, were skewed because they relied on the accounts of the first white settlers to arrive in an area.
There are over a dozen different diseases. It's not just smallpox and measles. So they're getting hit again and again. So yes, this has massive influence on the continent.
But the scale of this impact remains a highly contentious topic in the field of archaeology, and many experts, like Dr. Mark Plew, argue that the hunter-gatherer communities in the Great Basin region were too small and dispersed to be impacted by disease at all.
For the most part, these are very small populations, and we don't have anything in the archaeological record that would suggest anything more than, you know, that the average domicile is probably, 8 to 12 people most of the time. Western Idaho, the Hawaii country in particular, had a population density of probably one person per 16 square miles. There's a lot of people that never saw anybody else out there.
There could have been some epidemics here. You have to imagine that people in our region, in southern Idaho on south, they didn't live in the same groups all year. The groups were constantly fissioning and fusioning, but sometimes of the year, the salmon drives on the Snake are a good example, and all the way down to Columbia to get huge group sizes certain times of the year. The same with rabbit drives in the early winter. And when you've got a disease vector and you've got 100, 200 people in the one place at one time, now you have an opportunity to have a disease event.
The importance of these large gatherings in Shoshone Paiute culture is reiterated by Ted Howard.
The Boise area, they say there was camps that stretched for miles at times along that river.
I mean, we do know that, you know, ethnographically, in a number of areas in the West, but here as well, that people did aggregate, during the winter period. Now, whether or not that means they're living right next door to one another, that's another matter. Part of the problem is how you measure that or how you're going to archaeologically document it, demonstrate it.
Right.
And we have no evidence of that.
The attitude behind Dr. Plew's insistence on hard archaeological evidence in order to accept the large-scale human gatherings described by Ted Howard is a very common attitude in the field of archaeology, as Stephen Sims explains.
That is part of the problem that anthropology used in the early 20th century when we estimated North American Indian populations to be only about 1 million people north of Mexico. We were trying so hard to be empiricists that we just counted ancestors and used those literal counts as the pre-Columbian number. That's naive empiricism. You think that if you count it ever more precisely, it's somehow more true, when it's actually possible to be precisely wrong.
I don't know if there's any way to get a true figure or even something close, but our people we had many, many more people.
This depopulation was swirling around all the populations around the Great Basin from the Southern Snake River Plain on down to the Mojave Desert in California. We don't know the specifics of the impact.
So how big of an impact did disease have on the Western Shoshone and Northern Paiute people in Southwest Idaho before significant numbers of white settlers started to show up in the mid-1800s?
We may never fully understand the impact of disease in this region, but we do know that those first European settlers were not seeing a Shoshone and Paiute society untouched by European influence.
The Shoshone and Paiute people inhabit all of the Great Basin, from Southern California to Canada, back down to Mexico, into the Great Plains. We're a big, big group of people. Red, white, and the
blue. This is another thing we tend to do to us, to these hunter-gatherer societies, is we think they're so simple that they're unaware of what's going on around them. When in fact, the connections, both marriage and movement, are so broad that it's like my colleague Steve Lexon, who mostly works in the Southwest, he has a line that says, everybody knew everything. They may never have been to the Chumash villages in Santa Barbara, California, but they probably heard of them. They may never have seen a salmon fishing episode on the Snake River, but they heard of it.
This degree of communication and connectivity between tribes means that the arrival of the first white settlers in the Great Basin would not have come as a surprise. But tragically, as more European Americans arrived, the direct persecution of the Shoshone and Paiute people intensified.
You know, when the Euro-American people came, it was a new culture that came to our homeland. And they started pushing us off our lands and killing our people, and eventually did take our lands. And for them, it was a new beginning. For us, it was the end of a way of life. It was the end of the way our people lived their lives. And we're still struggling with that.
The Snake River Canyon has been occupied by the Shoshone and Paiute people and their ancestors for at least 14,500 years, a place-based history with a time depth that stretches so far back it's difficult for us to comprehend. While there is much that we can learn about the ancient history of these societies through analysis of the archaeological record, as well as through the oral history traditions of the Shoshone and Paiute people, it's also clear that much of this history has been lost, in large part a result of the racist attitudes and belief systems that once pervaded the field of archaeology. Although disease almost certainly had an impact on Shoshone and Paiute societies well before they had any direct interaction with European Americans, these tribes were spared the catastrophic effects of disease experienced throughout many other parts of the continent. They entered the 19th century with their cultural traditions largely intact. Sadly, this was about to change. Common Land is a production of the Wild Lens Collective and Radio Boise, with support from the Bureau of Land Management, the Birds of Prey NCA Partnership, the Peregrine Fund's Archives of Falconry, and a grant from Patagonia. This episode was produced by Wayne Burt, Steve Alsip, and myself, your host, Matt Podolsky.
Production support provided by Jessica Evett, Leah Dunn, Ragged Coyote, and Jennifer Jarrett. Our theme music is by Like a Rocket and Ragged Coyote. Additional music for this episode comes from Judy Trejo with Delgadina Gonzalez and Christina Gonzalez from their album Circle Dance Songs of the Paiute and Shoshone, as well as from Delray Strawbuck and Claude Siwash from their album Shoshone Paiute Peyote Songs. You can learn more about the Common Land Podcast and see a full credit list on our website at commonlandpodcast.com.
It seems like when we're talking about natural sciences or, you know, conservation, environmentalism, you know, a certain geographical area, like it's so easy to talk about what you see in front of you, you know, different flora, fauna, the statistics of that area, you know, the hard science. And there's so much about the way humans have interacted with those natural areas and have done so in a either productive or non-productive way or a destructive way. And that really is not, it seems to me that that is not a part of the equation until recently, at least in terms of like the way a popular, you know, a large population would look at it. Do you kind of get that impression from your interview with Ted Howard and the interview you did with the interviews you did with the archaeologists?
I mean, I got the impression that yes, you're right. If we're talking about sort of like mainstream, like white American culture, then yeah, like absolutely, right? A lot of that, a lot of the impacts that history, I mean, a lot of the history itself has been hidden intentionally. But like with that, when that history is hidden, then what's also hidden is the effects that history has had on the land and the interactions, right? And I mean, you know, I think it's really important for us to think about ourselves and humanity as a part of these natural systems. And if there's a whole like component of our history that is hidden from view, then we're also missing a huge part of the picture as far as like why these natural systems currently look the way that they do. Absolutely. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely a part of it. And like, hopefully folks kind of make some of that connection, you know, and that's certainly a part of the reason why it was so important to me to dive into like this component of the story of this particular area.
I mean, even the way we look at, you know, basically any piece of land, you know, the way popular society, namely that of like a white supremacy culture, is what is the economic value of that land outside of its intrinsic value naturally, right? Like, can I put a hotel on it?
Right.
No. Okay. Not worth a lot of money then.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, it's cool that you bring that aspect of it up, right? Because the episode that we just listened to kind of takes us through, you know, the title of the episode is Ancient History, right? So it's like we're looking really far back into the history of the human cultures that have lived on this landscape. But then we sort of take that history right up until the point when you have, you know, large numbers of white settlers coming into this area. And then we sort of, you know, that's sort of our ending point, right? And the next episode that comes after this in our first season of Common Land is called Unceded Land. And the whole premise of that episode is exploring land ownership.
Nothing problematic there, right?
Right. At the beginning, you know, in our intro, I was talking about sort of like the shift that, you know, these interviews and this reporting on this stuff sort of had on like my mindset. And that absolutely continues with like the follow-up episode to this, with episode 8 in Common Lands. We're talking about treaties that were never ratified by the Senate and, you know, debates over ownership of all of the land throughout the southwest portion of the state of Idaho. Those land titles are currently in dispute, right? And that doesn't just encompass the area of the NCA, which is the main focus of the Common Land Series, is this national conservation area in southwest Idaho, but it also encompasses like all of the city of Boise and like the land that I live on right here, you know, like right. is currently in dispute. My land title is in dispute. And so that's what we delve into in the next episode.
Oof, that's good.
Yeah.
Damn, that's good. Matthew Podolsky, thank you so much. If you have not listened to Common Land, it is very highly produced. It's a wonderful piece and a wonderful series, and just super recommended. Go do it. Listen to it. Rate and review. All that good shit.